This is an ABC podcast.
Countrywide on ABC Radio.
Support businesses are going to go to the wall just like dairy farmers will.
We've seen the whole agricultural community come out.
Once people leave communities, they generally don't return.
Countrywide.
Don't worry about me, go and speak to your farmers.
We're already losing businesses.
Get out there and speak to your farmers today. And jump at us all.
Countrywide, the politics of food and farming on ABC Radio.
Hello, Kelly Johnson here with you for Countrywide. Thanks so much for your company. Coming up in the next half hour, you'll hear why truckloads of avocados are being dumped and left to rot on the side of the road in Queensland.
It's devastating for farmers to do what they're doing. And a lot of people would say, don't eat the avocados. But at the end of the day, there's a cost to take that product off the farm. And the farmer's already put a big outlay in producing the crop. So it needs other people to step up.
And farmers are being warned to keep an eye out for mice and prepare to take action. Could we see a mouse plague similar to last year's return? Stay tuned to find out. But first, livestock owners across the country are on high alert following the detection of foot and mouth disease in Indonesia. FMD affects cows, sheep, pigs and other cloven-hoofed animals and has the potential to wipe out Australia's multi-billion dollar livestock sector if detected here. It comes after reports of more than 1,200 cases of the disease on two islands in Indonesia, North Sumatra and East Java. Experts believe it spread to the country through smuggling goats in from Malaysia. The Australian government has confirmed it is offering assistance to help control the outbreak and stop it from spreading any further south.
Well, I believe that this is the closest that foot and mouth disease has ever reached our nation. It is alarming. It is of concern.
That's Kathleen Plowman, CEO of one of Australia's key animal biosecurity groups, Animal Health Australia. She said while the spread of FMD to Indonesia is a huge threat, we're well prepared for an outbreak.
I have confidence in our government, in the support I can only imagine that they're offering to Indonesia in order to contain and eradicate this outbreak. Foot and mouth disease is a very serious disease for livestock. There are cloven-hoofed animals such as cattle, buffalo, sheep, goats, pigs, alpaca. It causes serious production losses and would also impact our international trade in livestock and livestock products. So it is serious. We should be concerned. I know that the Commonwealth Government, we're still facing really concerns around the spread of African swine fever, they put a number of measures at the border and at our ports, which are just as applicable for foot and mouth disease. So we've already got strong measures, and so that's the first step. The other step is that we practice a lot of exercises around emergency animal diseases to help us be better prepared. And we, of course, have the Emergency Animal Disease Response Agreement, which is about how parties, such as government and industries, it provides a framework how they'll respond to those diseases so that everybody can get on with the job as quickly as they can.
In response to the FMD outbreak, the government has announced some changes to import conditions and permits for some goods sourced or manufactured in Indonesia, including animal and environmental samples for laboratory use, such as dairy, meat, jerky or biltong and peat. Boats coming in from that country will need to meet all the existing requirements for cleaning and disinfection, including livestock carriers. Australia's Chief Veterinary Officer Dr. Mark Shipp told our reporter Steph Sinclair the government is also providing financial support to Indonesia to control the disease in their country.
So we have offered initially financial assistance to purchase a vaccine and to type the serotype of foot mouth disease that's present, because it's very important to match the serotype with the appropriate vaccine. Secondly, to offer technical assistance to provide veterinary officers from Australia to work alongside Indonesian veterinary officers on the ground in rolling out the response.
What does this outbreak mean for the Australian livestock sector? What is your level of concern?
So we are concerned that foot and mouth disease now is much closer to Australia than it was previously. Australia put a lot of effort into achieving foot-and-mouth disease freedom in our near neighbours in Papua New Guinea, Timor-Leste, Indonesia, over many years working with those countries to achieve foot-and-mouth disease freedom for their benefit, but also for ours. Having that disease now in Indonesia greatly increased the risk to our cattle, sheep, goat and pig industries.
And what would it mean if those industries were affected here? What does that look like?
So an estimate was done in 2013 that if we had a large-scale outbreak, it would be a $50 billion cost to those industries, because we would lose all of our export markets for any of the products from those industries. And that would have devastating consequences for those industries and on the domestic market, as all of that product came back onto the domestic market. So it has very significant trade consequences, as well as the animal health and animal welfare consequences of a disease that can on occasion cause death, but it does cause quite a high degree of illness in affected animals.
How much does the spread of FMD to Indonesia heighten the risk of a spread to Australia?
We estimated 2 years ago that the risk was 9% within the next 5 years. We haven't repeated that assessment as yet. We plan to do that in the coming weeks, but I would expect that risk would have at least doubled given the proximity of Indonesia, the trade that we have with Indonesia in sending live cattle up there, and the risk of returning stockmen and travellers from Indonesia.
We've got lumpy skin disease on our doorstep as well. Is it possible that both of these diseases come to Australia at the same time, and how much of an impact would that have?
It would be very remote possibility, a vanishingly small possibility, but if it were to occur, the consequences would be absolutely devastating for our livestock industries. And that's why we're taking it very seriously in having a foot-and-mouth disease vaccine bank on hand and importing lumpy skin disease virus and looking at what lumpy skin disease vaccines are available.
Head of the Australian Veterinary Association, Dr. Christy Seacombe, is concerned the shortage of vets in rural and regional areas will put Australia's biosecurity at risk as livestock diseases such as lumpy skin disease and foot and mouth disease inch closer, and we may not be as prepared for an outbreak as some think.
It's a huge issue, and it's not just in Victoria or even just in Australia. It's actually a global issue in terms of getting veterinarians out regionally and rurally to provide services to the community. It's a bit like other health professions in that respect, is that it's sometimes quite difficult to make sure that rural and regional areas have all of the services that they need. And in the veterinary sector, it's further complicated by the after-hour obligations that veterinarians need to provide to the community. So what's happening is that it's been recognised for a period of time that this isn't sustainable, and we are now seeing the effects of it not being sustainable. People are shutting services down, or in worst-case scenarios, they're actually closing their veterinary businesses. And so what this means is that animals won't be getting the care that they need, and it actually puts Australia's biosecurity at risk.
The news is bringing back memories for Australians who experienced the horrendous FMD outbreak in the United Kingdom 2 decades ago. Andrew Biddle is a vet with local land services, but was working in the UK as a vet when the outbreak occurred.
The impact on local communities on individual farmers was much greater. I mean, for me personally, it was just something that I hadn't seen up until that time, and you know, and by the time I got there, they were doing large off-farm burials, and I think part of it was just the sheer scale of the exercise of, you know, doing all of this work on individual farms, and then, you know, going to these, you know, large mass burial areas that they were that they'd developed to streamline and make it as efficient as they could and less confronting for communities.
Northern New South Wales vet Andrew Biddle. It's been a shocking year for avocado growers who have experienced some of the lowest prices in at least a decade. Photos emerged on social media of truckloads of the fruit dumped and left to rot on the side of the road in the Atherton Tablelands. And I'm talking truckloads. It would have been a devastating decision to make for these farmers. But as Far North Queensland Growers President Joe Moreau tells Kate Banville, it was likely a decision they saw coming for a while, because the price is so low, it may not have been commercially viable to market them.
The general mood in the avocado industry is very, very low at this point in time. There's a lot of production that's come out this year, and also there's still not really great, strong, super demand that was there, say, before COVID in the marketplace. So those two factors have led to some very low prices, some of the lowest prices they've probably experienced as an avocado industry going back probably 8, 9, maybe even 10 years. So it's something that has not probably been a big surprise, but at the same time, it has hit them financially this year. And I would say a lot of avocado growers would be pretty either breaking even or even in a lot of cases producing product that's below the cost of supply price, so they'll be making losses this year. So it's been a big hard year for the avocado industry.
And let's just look into those factors at play a little bit more in terms of what's causing the lowest prices that we've seen in a long time. Is that an oversupply issue? Are there too many farmers now in the avocado industry to meet the demand?
Well, in a short answer, you probably would say yes to that. And the avocado industry has tried to do a number of things to avoid this situation by increasing exports, which they have. They've increased their export over the years. But I think COVID, as I said earlier, I think it's complicated matters for lots of reasons. One, it's affected the domestic trade with a lot of the cafes still, you know, not getting up to full capacity. And also exports haven't been as strong as they should be as they have been pre-COVID. So all those factors have come into play, plus a lot more plantings have gone into the ground. If you drive around the Tablelands, you'll see them. And there's still some trees going into the ground, even though some farmers know that they probably shouldn't be doing that because those trees have been pre-bought and the commitment's been made to plant those trees. So there's going to be some difficult years for the avocado industry while it sorts out its production. And oversupply is what you'll see on the market for a period of time.
The Tablelands would usually be a hive of activity at this time of year with tourists, international tourists particularly, who would be eating a lot of these avocados, but that demand slump has surely been driven also by the fact that we've had closed borders and that slowed migration throughout the country as well.
Well, yeah, any of the restrictions have caused effect on use of any of a lot of our fruit and vegetables, and avocados definitely is one of those. Avocado, but also the fact that a lot of the CBDs have been shut down for long periods of time and only starting to reopen. And although they've been reopened for a period of time, the amount of activity is still relatively lower than what it was before COVID. There's a lot of factors in play why demand has been impacted as well. Predominantly, it's increased production which has driven most of the impact. But yes, definitely, if the tourism industry had been active for longer, I mean, even the cruise industry, for example, it's only just restarted. They take product, you know, they stock up when they're in Australia and they take product with them. Avos is definitely one that would be on that itinerary list of product that they take. So all those things has played a factor. So in a way, the planets have all aligned for avocado to have them a very, very big shock to their whole productive and productivity and profitability. And the bottom line has definitely been impacted.
So as consumers, what can we do to support the avocado industry? I mean, in this case where we've seen the devastating photos on social media of truckloads of avocados dumped, people trying to put it back on the farmer, saying, take it to the markets, give it to the homeless. But it's the farmer that has to foot that bill at the end of the day. So what can we as consumers do?
Well, the only thing we'd encourage any consumer to do is buy more avocados and buy as many as you can. You're never going to get a deal as good as you're going to get now, especially in some of the more areas where you will see fruit coming more direct from the farm. For example, some of the markets around Farnham, but even in the in Woolies and Coles, you know, buy more avocados. As simple as that. Buy more fruit and vegetables because it's devastating for farmers to do what they're doing. And you're spot on in saying it's a lot of people would say, you know, donate the avocados, but I donate a lot of fruit, and I'm a mango grower, and you can only donate so much. At the end of the day, there's a cost to take that product off the farm, and the farmer's already put a big outlay in producing the crop, so it needs other people to step up. But there is product there, and I'm sure some farmers will help out. But remember, it's all part of the natural process of what we call within the supply-demand mechanisms of the fruit and vegetable industry, and there's a big cost for farmers to take product and send it further away, because all the avocado production in far north Queensland, if it was just, it cannot be just sold in far north Queensland. It would have to be sold right across Australia. There are people making decisions. They've got avocados on the tree, whether to just cut them and drop them on the ground and things like that. So that's the tip of the iceberg.
Far North Queensland Growers President Joe Moreau ending that report by Kate Banville. And if you head over to the ABC's rural website or Facebook page, you can see the devastating photos of the avocados dumped on the side of the road.
Countrywide, the voice of regional Australia on ABC Radio.
As the election campaign continues, the Coalition has launched its $1.7 billion plan for agriculture. Really, most of the parts of this plan have already been previously announced, and much of it is already in the federal budget. But David Littleproud was out and about in Shepparton to make the announcement.
Australian agriculture, for the first time in our nation's history, will hit $80 billion. That's an astounding outcome considering all that we face up to. Droughts, fires, floods, cyclones and COVID. And to think that in 2014-15 we're only a $47 billion industry shows the resilience of farmers. But our job is to put that environment and infrastructure around our farmers. And we've done that, whether that be with the Future Drought Fund, a $5 billion fund, giving a $100 million dividend every year, invested back into our regional communities to make them more resilient. Whether that be the Regional Investment Corporation, that's given, particularly in the drought, zero interest, zero repayment loans, then also helping young people through the Agri-Starter loans. Whether that's been us standing shoulder to shoulder with our dairy farmers against the supermarkets, $1 a litre milk. We put in place a dairy code of conduct around the country of origin labelling. We're saying to Australians, we're empowering Australians to support Australian farmers with a green and gold kangaroo and a barcode on the bottom that says to them, you can be the deciding factor of whether you want to support an Australian farmer or not. It was the National Party that stood tall on an ag visa. We've got it up and we've got Vietnam signed up. And that goes to the heart of supporting, complementing and supplementing what we've been able to achieve with the Pacific schemes. But this goes further. It's actually a skilled and semi-skilled visa, giving a pathway to permanent residency. This is about making sure that we look to the future. And we've looked to the future with our Future Farmers Guarantee. A $1 million guarantee to back them in part of their guarantee, part of the deposit that they'll give to their bank, to give young people a red hot crack at having a go at agriculture. The biggest impost is the capital costs in getting started. But we're also making sure that they're getting a fair go. And what I've been concerned about for some time has been about the perishable goods nature in which trade between our big two Australian supermarkets and the big German, about how they've treated farmers. They own 75% of supermarket share. And that brings into place a power imbalance. And what farmers want isn't a free hit. They just want a fair price. And what we've said, we instigated the ACCC inquiry to make sure that we got underneath the bonnet of this. And they came back with two key recommendations. And the first was about making sure that there was transparency. Transparency for our farmers in understanding their market, so that when they went and negotiated, they're on the same footing as a supermarket. And today, as part of that, there's $5.4 million we announced as part of that ACCC inquiry. $1.75 million will go to the horticulture sector. $650 million of that will go towards making and creating a platform that all of horticulture will be able to participate and understand in bringing together the markets, the combined markets around the country as well as international, so that our farmers have an understanding of where prices are, but also the volumes that are being traded. $1 million, over $1 million with ABARES, particularly for the apple and pear industry. Hearing from producers on the ground that there is an imbalance and that the cost of production is not reflective at the supermarket means that Australians should understand what the cost of production is. So ABARES will work with the industry, the apple and pear industry, whether it be here in Shepparton, whether it be Batlow or whether it be Stanthorpe. We'll be sitting down and going through and working and understanding the cost of production so that there is transparency, and that feeds in to that platform so that not just farmers know what the cost of production, what the volumes and what the prices are, they'll know what they're negotiating with and against with supermarkets.
Agriculture Minister, the Nationals' David Littleproud. And the ABC has reached out to the Labor Party for a wrap on their agriculture plan, but they haven't been able to speak just yet. However, the opposition has announced it would effectively axe Australia's agriculture visa before a foreign worker could arrive on the scheme. They say an Albanese Labor government would instead establish a new agriculture stream within the existing Pacific Australia Labor Mobility Scheme, replacing the specific visa for forestry, fishery and farm workers announced by the coalition last year. They would also pay the upfront travel costs of Pacific workers travelling to Australia, allow Pacific workers to bring their families to live and work here, and promote permanent residency on a new Pacific engagement visa. And they've also confirmed the country's $92 million live sheep export industry will be shut down if they're elected. However, they would not make any changes to the live cattle export trade. Grain growers are being warned to keep an eye out for mice and prepare to take action. Experts say another mouse plague would be unusual but not impossible if proper action isn't taken in the coming months. CSIRO researcher Steve Henry says if numbers can be knocked back now before spring, that gives a much lower breeding population base. He says there's currently a significant outbreak in Western Australia, but mice have also been seen in central and southern Queensland, South Australia, northern Victoria, as well as northern New South Wales.
What we're really focusing on at the moment is getting farmers really vigilant to take action as we go into the winter, because obviously there's some really high-value crops, particularly canola crops, that are being sown at the moment, and it's really important to protect those crops as we sow them. But the added benefit of protecting those crops is that we'll be pushing numbers low as we go into winter. That potentially reduces the amount of overwinter survival of populations, which means next spring when they start to breed again, they start to breed from a lower population base and the rate of increase is slower. That doesn't mean that we can say, oh, we've done a really good job in the autumn, we don't have to worry about them in the spring. Still have to keep monitoring early in the spring so we can be proactive if numbers start to increase.
When you say we're seeing high numbers in some parts of the country already, what sort of numbers are we talking? Do you measure it like a population per a hectare or something?
So we talk about monitoring mice. It's very difficult to get absolute numbers per hectare. One of the ways we do it at this time of the year is to get a count of active burrows in paddocks, and then you can make some assumptions. So if you've got one active burrow per 100 square metres, that equates to 100 burrows per hectare. And if you've got 100 burrows per hectare and you make an assumption that there's two mice per active burrow, then you're up around 200 mice per hectare. And then we know if mice have 6 to 10 babies every 19 to 21 days, if you've got 200 mice per hectare, you're not very far away from a big problem.
Not at all. I'm just thinking, Steve, if we sort of compare to, it would have been, I guess, 2 years ago, it was the spring of 2020, wasn't it, when we really saw our mice numbers start picking up again. If we compare now to sort of 2 years ago, do you think there is the possibility for us to get up to those plague numbers again if proper action isn't taken right now?
So it would be unusual to have a significant outbreak like the one that we saw last year 2 years in a row. It is possible, but one of the really good things at the moment is that we're not getting very many reports of high numbers of mice through those areas of the central west of New South Wales that were so heavily affected. It has been incredibly wet through that area, and I know that farmers are just sitting waiting for the country to dry out enough to sow it. So we might start to get more reports once the crop starts to go in. But I suspect that farmers this year are significantly more vigilant than they have been in the past, just simply because they were so terribly affected last year.
CSIRO researcher Steve Henry speaking there with Amelia Bernasconi. Working dogs like Kelpies and Border Collies are known for their love of the job, but sometimes circumstances mean they need a new purpose or a second chance off-farm. That's where Dogs for Jobs comes in, a community service focused on rehoming working dogs. The charity's founder, Perry Chappell, is from a farm in Deniliquin in the New South Wales Riverina region, but she says there's now volunteers from all over Australia.
So Dogs for Jobs is a working dog rehoming organisation. So we rescue and rehome working breed dogs all over Australia. They can be Kelpies, Border Collies, Coolies, cattle dog. So, yeah, we have 116 volunteers around the country, currently operating in every state but the Northern Territory. So the dogs come into our care and go to our wonderful volunteer foster carers' homes until they're ready for adoption.
And why did you start this program?
So I grew up on the land, and after school I moved to the city and did all that. And 9 years later I moved back to Denny onto the family farm. And I guess in all that time I was shocked the first time I heard that farmers were still just knocking pups on the head. I thought, you know, we were well past that. So that's sort of what led me into starting my own organisation. I'd done some fostering dogs with another organisation and just wanted to work a bit more with the rural community and work on, you know, outreach and education and letting people know that there is another option, as well as, you know, working with the pounds and the shelters, RSPCA, all of that, and Metropolitan as well.
What are most of the situations that you come into contact with? Why are most people sort of in this situation where they're wanting to have their dogs adopted?
Yeah, so I explain it to people in this sort of four different ways. So there's the genuine hardship cases who have, you know, experienced some sort of hardship in life, whether it be people on the land with the drought, the fires, the floods. Most of your listeners will know how tough farming is. It doesn't need to be a natural disaster for people to do it tough. So there's those ones. And then, you know, I guess in the more suburban areas, the hardship cases are people facing, you know, work or housing battles, family, things like that. We have helped a lot of domestic violence women as well. While they get up on their feet. And then there's the other half of that aspect, which is the people that got a working breed dog and either the dog is unsuitable or they made the wrong choice or a not well-informed choice in the breed of dog that they got. With that is also people that are just not great to their animals and want to just dump them. And so within that, people often, you know, ask me, you know, or imply to me that the farming community is worse, but I think it's about 50-50 where our dogs come from, is in people in suburbia and people on farms.
Do you have farmers as well who adopt or foster dogs and they do become working dogs?
Yeah, absolutely. So honestly, the majority of our foster carers are in a suburban environment, but the more people that learn about what we're doing, especially a lot of working dog people who have, you know, safe, secure dog pens and crates and whatnot, they find out and they're like, yeah, send me a dog. If you've got one that's going crazy or it, you know, has shown some potential, send it here and we'll do, you know, test it on sheep and get it started. So we don't have enough of those, to be honest, though. We need more. But there's plenty of farmers that do come across what we do and get in touch and say, do you have any dogs that, you know, would suit cattle or sheep? And yeah, plenty that'll also take a pup on and give it a go if it comes from working parents.
Dogs for Jobs founder Perry Chappell speaking to Olivia Carver. And that's all we have time for on Countrywide. You can catch up on more rural stories online at abc.net.au/rural. I'm Kelly Johnson. Thanks again for your company.
Discover more great ABC podcasts, live radio, and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.